Alexander, it's a real pleasure to have you on Take It From Us. Welcome to the show for the first time. Have you done radio interviews before?
I've done one other interview before many years ago, but it's certainly nice to be here.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, well, that wasn't with the Nutters Club or anything like that, no?
No, it was Talkback, and it was about 5 or 6 years ago. So
right, yeah.
It's good to be here.
So you work in a variety of roles in the community. Can you tell us something about that?
Yeah, sure. So I work in Smoke Free. I work in mental health and recovery. As you mentioned before, I work as a counsellor. So in that counselling role, I work with men that have been sexually abused in childhood. And I also have my own little business as well, working with DHB and social services, providing training courses on how to work with men on a whole variety of issues and challenges.
So you've got any spare time to sit back and relax?
Yeah, absolutely. And in that relaxation process, that's about doing that PhD.
Really? Is that a relaxation?
It is. It really is.
Yeah?
Yes.
Well, you must be enjoying what you're doing in terms of that research then.
Absolutely. And I think all the work that I do contributes to that research and vice versa. And so I think that for me is what I mean. I really enjoyed it. I'm very passionate about it.
So that free counselling that you are doing in South Auckland, I get, obviously it's not a deliberate strategy to identify men, but I guess you are coming across men who could assist you in the PhD research.
Yeah, so that particular counselling's been offered for the last 6 years. It's often been self-referral, and from that, I've noticed that there's no research, or hardly any actually, in New Zealand in relation to men who have been sexually abused in childhood. And so given that, I made the decision last year to step up, and rather than ask the question, where is it, and ask myself that question about maybe it's something I should do.
You were sort of offered an incentive by a senior clinician at one stage to get involved in maybe higher qualifications. Do you want to say?
Yeah, absolutely. About that? So initially, my background, like as you've said before, is as a counsellor, and I was quite happy with that role. Love it to bits. But I'm also an advocator as well. And so when I was working in a mental health service that will remain nameless, I was advocating for a client, and a doctor that I was talking to suggested that there were two types of doctors that he listened to. One had either PhDs or one that were medical doctors. And because I was neither, he wasn't going to have any of my time. So I took that to be a positive thing personally, and decided that actually maybe I should do a PhD. I don't think that was his intention at all.
He was just putting you down.
Absolutely. However, I'm glad in a sense that I had that experience, because here I am, taking that challenge on.
Yeah. Whereabouts are you in that process?
So I'm just kickstarting it, i.e. at the very beginning. I completed a second master's last year that looked at working with cultural frameworks around men who have been sexually abused. There was a huge gap around it. So I spent 6 months doing a master's specifically focusing on this framework. I've now taken that research on board and implemented it into this PhD.
Can you explain just a little bit about what your response there, a cultural framework? Mm. So you're specifically devoting your research to one particular culture?
Absolutely. So my background, or how I identify, is Māori. Māori have rates that aren't exactly the greatest across the board in terms of health. And so I've decided to specialise working with men who have been, Māori men who have been sexually abused in childhood.
What are some of the outcomes of that sexual abuse, particularly when it happens at a young age?
So I think it's really important to acknowledge that the stats around people who have been sexually abused in general aren't quantitative. They tend to be kind of broad. So, for example, rape prevention education talks about 1 in 4 females will be sexually abused, 1 in 8 males will be sexually abused. Domestic violence campaign will say it's about 1 in 10 for men. But if you look internationally, the stats are around 1 in 6. And that's what I suspect would be the rates of sexual abuse for men who have experienced it in New Zealand.
Men don't have much of a voice when it comes to the issue of domestic violence. And, you know, there was a lot of very, well, what was described as shameful publicity around the reported rate of domestic violence in New Zealand. I think it was over 100,000 cases probably reported to police over the past 12 months or something. But, you know, all us men are told that we're the perpetrators.
Mm-hmm.
And I know this is a very controversial issue, but having my own personal experience of standover tactics by a woman who was supposedly close to me in my life, that was very detrimental to my mental health.
Yes, yes. And so I guess it would be kind of a nice little thing to add that, you know, violence, whether it be, you know, men with giving violence to women or vice versa, from my perspective, is just not okay. But when it comes to men who have experienced, say, domestic violence, you don't often hear their voice. There's a whole raft of reasons why that occurs. Certainly from the past of working with previous people who might go to the police and want to make a complaint, my experiences have been in that the police don't seem to want to engage with those particular men. It's often seen as a bit of a joke. And so as a result, those men don't tend to step up and want to take it further.
Well, that would be a major disincentive if it was treated by the police as a bit of a joke.
Certainly from my experiences, yeah.
So you've got some thoughts around, I mean, not only may it be treated by a joke, but as a joke, but there's not a lot of incentive. I mean, people probably feel more comfortable about staying silent.
Absolutely. So both research as well as personal experience of working in the field shows that there's still a lot of silence around men coming forward. There's certainly a lot of shame about that. The Kiwi attitude is still very much, she'll be right and harden up. So if you fall outside that norm, you're going to be someone who's going to have to face a little bit more of a challenge being heard. And so with that, I guess, comes the fact that there is stigma involved as well. Mm. And also, just as you said before, a lot of standover tactics as well. You know, i.e. if you go forward, no one will believe you. Who would believe, for example, that you as a husband or as a partner would be having some kind of violence against your partner? You know, that would be seen to be very difficult to be believed.
Let's go back to one of the earlier questions. I mean, what attracted you to work in the sector of mental health and addictions, and I guess sexual abuse as well?
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess initially when I first started in this field, I was about 15 or 16 years old, and I really wanted a job that would last me for the rest of my life. And so I was doing
a big ask these
days. That's a big ask, isn't it?
But when you're my age, you sort of had that expectation and could just about fulfill it.
But absolutely. And so I was reading in the Courier at the time about how the rates of alcohol and addictions correlated with the recessions that happen. And I just thought, well, that would be a really great job to get into, because obviously when people are, you know, aren't in a good state of mind, that will mean more jobs that are available in the field. And of course, when the economy gets better, people are still coming off their bits and pieces, and so I'll still need a job. And so here I am 20 years later in the field.
In demand has continued.
And I guess the sexual violence stuff was really a spin-off that I hadn't initially foresaw. That came maybe 5 or 6 years once I was really into the field, working predominantly with men, and then having those disclosures come.
In your experience in mental health and addictions, though, have there been people close to you that have experienced
mental health, sexual abuse? Absolutely. So again, you know, those stats around 1 in 6 would be true to people that I certainly know. I think that when I'm working with, say, some of my friends about getting them help, it can be really tricky how you manage someone who says has anxiety. That anxiety might have been triggered by being sexually abused in childhood. And so often people might want to get, say, some kind of treatment around the anxiety, but not want to disclose what had happened that had caused the anxiety to take place.
Yeah, well, the Professor John Reid, who we interviewed a couple of times on Take It From Us, he was with the University of Auckland, is now, I think, at a university in the UK. But his belief was that if anybody presents to a counsellor or a psychiatrist, mm-hmm. psychologist, even, well, Lifeline, any of those sorts of services, yes. that the question needs to be asked very early on in the first session as to whether any domestic violence or yes. sexual abuse had occurred in that person's history.
And I completely support that. I think one of the challenges, though, is that health professionals, as well as those that work in social services, just feel really uncomfortable about asking that to a woman, let alone asking a man whether or not they had experienced domestic violence or even sexual violence. I can remember reading some research last year that indicated that out of 300 health professionals, only 15% would feel comfortable asking a man whether or not they had experienced some kind of domestic violence. That rate of asking was significantly less, about 3 or 4%, around sexual abuse. So asking men whether they've experienced abuse in itself is tricky. Asking them whether they've experienced some kind of sexual violence in their life is even more challenging.
I mean, I guess it was a feeling that I had when we were talking outside of the studio itself, and I asked you whether you'd had a diagnosis, and I thought, well, I guess I do ask that regularly on radio, and so I feel a bit more comfortable about it, but it could be very... what's the right word? Encroaching.
Absolutely. And it's a good question to ask. So, no, I haven't had an official diagnosis from a doctor, although I do experience bouts of depression, but non-medicated.
Right.
Well, non-medicated would be the answer.
Well, it sounds as though you're a busy person. You know about balance in life, do you?
I do.
Managing your stresses.
I think it's important that if you're going to be working with people around self-care and strategies around looking after self, that you better start implementing it personally.
Absolutely. Today we're talking to Alexander Stevens, who's a counsellor, and dual diagnosis. Jai, I'm having struggling saying that word, diagnosis, a clinician, working in the health and social sectors. He's also a co-chair of the Auckland Community Mental Health Trust, which of course is providing the governance to Changing Minds. And we will be talking to Kieran Moorhead from Changing Minds a little bit later in our show for our mental health talking points. But Alexander, your aspirations in terms of career and academic study?
So I used to lecture on the applied degree in social work, and I really enjoyed that. And I think for me, future aspirations certainly would want to go back into academia as well as working at grassroots level with our community. I certainly think one of my aspirations certainly is the ability for a man to be able to come forward, to be able to disclose they've been sexually abused, and to be able to get the appropriate support and help that they need.
You did have an aspiration to be Professor of Happiness, I believe.
I did. So when I was 18 or 19, I thought it'd be fantastic to, be the Professor of Happiness. But I've realised that, as destiny would have it, apparently mental health and trauma seems to be the way that I'm going. So I'm not quite sure what that's going to look like in terms of having some kind of title of being Professor of Mental Health and Trauma doesn't quite fit with me.
There's a big gap between the Professor of Happiness and the Professor of Trauma and Mental Health.
I'm certainly hoping to find some kind of new title in the next 3 years.
Yeah, maybe you could become one of these online gurus as the Professor of Happiness.
Maybe. Fortune. We'll see what destiny holds.
Yeah. Yes. Who's the person that, Wayne Dyer is one of them, isn't it? Somebody else who's regarded as the sort of Professor of Happiness and Mental Health at the moment.
Yes.
I'm just trying to think who it is.
Absolutely. And so for me, we'll see what happens.
I'm wondering if sexuality is an issue in this sexual abuse.
So this doesn't necessarily apply to all boys, but certainly there is a small percentage of boys who are sexually abused that do question their sexuality. That's not to confuse, homosexual or lesbian, that those are different things, And so, for example, young boys who might be sexually abused by men might question, why was it that this man abused me? And what does this mean in terms of how I identify myself? Mm. Conversely, if a woman was to sexually abuse a young boy, there tends to be a lot of stigma around the fact that you should enjoy it, because it was a woman and she's taken advantage of you and she's brought you into manhood. So there can be lots of questions about who am I, and what does this mean for me in the long term? Mm.
What are you finding out about the mental health impacts of sexual abuse?
So certainly high rates of anxiety, schizophrenia and depression tends to be what the research states internationally. I guess it also acknowledges the fact that we also have a high rate of suicide in New Zealand, and a lot of that also is around those people who have been sexually abused and haven't necessarily got the support or help that they rightfully deserve. And I'm really clear that it is a right. It's not a need. It's not a service. It is a right to be able to get kind of help to deal with that kind of trauma.
I mean, has that been revealed through suicide prevention campaigns? And that's, I've never heard that said before.
No. I think because there's so much research that needs to be done in New Zealand, it's not something that you probably would hear outside of your own, you know, area. But certainly because I work in the sector and hear stories that come forward, it's something that I'm much more familiar with.
Mm. I mean, our worst suicide statistics are in the 16 to 24,
mm-hmm.
Have you already discovered some facts that some of those people in that age group have been sexually abused?
So certainly with people that I've worked in the past, and remember that when you're young, you're still developing mentally and physically. And so if you've got that added baggage of being sexually abused, and that just makes life a little bit more complicated. So certainly my experience, my clinical experiences has been very much so of working with young men who have been sexually abused, who are thinking about suicide, who do have a lot of questions about why did this occur, and ultimately wanting to know, is there hope and how can they get help?
Well, how do they get help?
So I guess what I would say for those callers that are listening is I would be calling, if you or someone that you know has been sexually abused, I would be calling the ACC Sensitive Claims, and you can get in touch with them through an 0800 number. So it's 0800 735 566. That's 0800 735 566.
So you're saying that the Accident Compensation Corporation has some sort of support helpline?
So the Sensitive Claims Unit is taken on by ACC. They do process, which does sound a bit clinical, but they do process applications around people that have been sexually abused. Traditionally, you might want to go to your GP, you might want to go to a counsellor, but again, that kind of depends on where your state of mind is at. And sometimes for people, they might just want to go directly to the source, i.e. ACC, just to make some inquiries about where to from here.
I identify ACC as being a place where you get some sort of financial support for a sports injury or a long-term injury or when you're laid off work or whatever. So in this area of sexual abuse, this you call it the sensitive claims.
That's right.
Line.
And I think it might be really good to kind of mention now that that the impacts of sexual abuse impacts New Zealand over $1 billion a year. And so some of that money comes from, say, lost productivity, people taking their lives, the impacts of accessing different services. So ACC has put money aside to work with people that have been sexually abused to help them with counselling.
So ACC might have a fund or do have a fund where they could pay the counselling or the psychiatrist. I mean, another major cost to the country must be those who end up in mental health services as a result of being sexually abused.
Oh, absolutely. And then if you also factor in the costs of, say, smoking, drinking, marijuana and other things that people do to deal with being sexually abused, then you're dealing with billions and billions of dollars.
I mean, we have this very positive campaign in New Zealand called Equally Well.
Mm-hmm.
And this is to try and address the issue that people with lived experience of mental health and addictions die 20 to 25 years younger than the rest of the population.
That's right.
I mean, if this was happening to housewives instead of those with mental health and addictions problem, that'd be an absolute outcry.
Agreed. And I think that's why you're dealing with a lot of that judgment and stigma in relation to having mental health. And then you deal with those other things that people are subjected to by life. And then what you're dealing with is a really vulnerable population group. And I just think it's such a shame that having a mental health or having a mental illness and living with it, you know, kind of correlates with less time on this fantastic earth. It's a shame. It's a real shame.
Yeah. I mean, it does become a sort of a vicious spiral of, I guess, getting on to a sickness benefit or whatever they're called today, having limited funds, possibly smoking, not being able to feed oneself as healthily, possibly, I guess, medication that inhibits exercise, those sorts of things. And there are also in that document, the sort of positioning paper, they state quite categorically that some of the psychotic medication is linked to diabetes and other physical illnesses.
And so I guess then you've got to kind of question what's being done about that. So in my own particular practice, I'm all about ensuring that for people to take not only medication, but to find other ways of being able to manage wellness. Mm. And so when I'm looking at those impacts around side effects, I think that it's acknowledging that Pharmac take on and fund certain medication that's available in New Zealand. Mm-hmm. However, there's other medication internationally that is used with people with the lived experience of mental health that aren't available here. Mm-hmm. So I guess that's kind of about the community maybe questioning about what other types of medication are being used overseas that might not necessarily have the same kind of impacts, and what can we do to get them into this country?
But they could be equally, if not more effective, is that
potentially
what you're saying?
Potentially is the key word.
Right. What other strategies, though, do you promote? You said, I think, well-being outside of medication. What are some of the other things that you advocate?
So I guess for me, I'm really clear that the best possible way of either recovery or taking a journey into wellness is to hopefully have at least one person that truly believes in your potential. Now, whether that's a family member, a friend, a loved one, or actually even just say your own dog, your own cat, someone, something that believes in your potential is all it really takes to kind of get you going. And there's a lot of research out there that shows that just that one person believing in your potential to help you to work towards your own, journey or whatever you'd like to call it, can make a significant difference to your own mental health.
We call that peer support.
Absolutely. And I think for me, peer support can work in conjunction, with people, say, outside of the mental health community, because a lot of people that I do work with certainly have support structures within mental health, but they want to have structures outside of mental health, in communities where they might not necessarily know or have people that are aware of their own mental illness, for example. So as an example, I might have a client who might identify as saying, might be queer, so gay or lesbian, but they might also have depression and anxiety as well. So in my particular role, it might be, how can I support you within the mental health sector to get the support that you need around the depression and anxiety? But yeah, how can I also support you with accessing appropriate services in the rainbow communities so that you have your different needs and wants met?
I mean, the tragedy with that particular group, and there's been quite a bit of research done on this, is that it's a bit of a double whammy in terms of discrimination, isn't it? In that the mental health services so often discriminate against gay and lesbian, LGBT community, and I guess the mental health diagnosis is just another complication.
But I do like to acknowledge that there are some good organisations that are working towards understanding this particular population group, our rainbow community, and how can we work with, different sectors of our society in a way that kind of uplifts their self-esteem.
Well, Affinity Services, in fact, was very much involved, I think, in that piece of research about mental health services and the gay and lesbian community. And there was, I think, one of of the senior funding people from ADHB that sort of promoted that and identified people who could do the research.
Absolutely. And I think part of that offshoot that came with that looked at the rainbow tick and how can organisations get that. So, you know, similar to the heart tick through the Heart Foundation and buying good food, you look for this particular, you know, tick approval.
Right. Yeah.
Same deal with social services and organisations. You know, if you do identify as being queer, here's an organisation that's earned the rainbow tick so that you can feel safe to be able to go.
Do you know any of those organisations that you could tell us about?
Yeah, not at the top of my head. That would have been good to know before.
Okay. I think Affinity Services, they're in Great South Road, sort of Green Lane area. Mm. Certainly they had a couple of staff that were working on that piece of research. We've sort of touched on things like recovery and hope, and you've indicated how important it is to have, you know, somebody standing beside you, somebody that believes in your potential,
yes.
whether it be the your own cat or dog or your mate or mother or whatever. That's one of the paths to recovery and hope.
Yes, and certainly in relation to sexual abuse, that's even more important, that if you are the person who's being received the disclosure from someone, that that you trust what they're saying. And sometimes that can actually be really hard. You know, I've worked with clients in the past who have spoken about talking, you know, so they've disclosed that they've been sexually abused, and then initially the response has been, I don't believe you, or I don't know what to do with this, or conversely, I do know about it, but I don't want to talk about it. So when we're looking at this idea of recovery and hope, it really starts from that initial engagement, that if someone has discussed or disclosed to you that they have been sexually abused, that you, the listener, can do something positive with this particular person and help them from the get-go.
How would you recommend, you've heard that disclosure, how would you recommend the right response to be?
I guess it kind of depends on the nature of it. So has the sexual abuse occurred within the family, or has it occurred, you know, outside? So if we're looking, say, within the family, so that can be a really difficult area, because often, more often than not, people know who the abuser is, but they don't want to name him, or they don't want them to come forward for fear that it might kind of unravel other stuff. And so we know that with sexual abuse, that there can often be a historical significant, you know, trauma that's occurred, not only within that particular person, but within other families as well. So if you're hearing that disclosure, sometimes you might be thinking to yourself, well, this is the last thing that I want to deal with. So what I'd say to you is that I would be ringing some great organizations like Lifeline, for example, and asking them, how do I go about supporting this person, but maybe also myself as well?
The only thing with Lifeline, of course, is that, and I've been a telephone counselor for several years, the third party often can't make the call to Lifeline.
No, but what they could do, though, is encourage that particular person to maybe come up with their own strategies of how to work with this particular problem. I know that, and I'm just kind of mindful of me, and if I was, say, working with a woman, then it would be relatively easy, because I would recommend somewhere like Help Services or maybe Shine. But if you're a man, actually the kind of support that you get is very limited in New Zealand. There's Male Against Sexual Abuse Trust, which you can go onto Google. Ken Clearwater is the director. Good man. But for men wanting to get help for themselves, it's very difficult. It was one of the reasons why I did the free counselling initially.
So do you want to say more about that free counselling? It's still carrying on, is it?
Yes. So at the moment, taking on this PhD obviously has taken a certain amount of time. However, I do have some space available. I do have my own website, so is this a good time to kind of chuck that
good.
On? So if you go online and do www.indigenoushealth.co.nz, go onto the contact link, send me through your details. I might not necessarily be able to take you on myself, but I could hopefully help refer you to somebody who I believe would be appropriate.
Oh, that's brilliant. Just give us that website again.
Sure. So that's www.indigenoushealth.co.nz.
And you're providing that at a venue in South Auckland, aren't you?
Absolutely. And I tend to, So when I'm meeting with a person initially, it might be just getting an idea about in what way could I help. It might be like what I've said before, referring them on to ACC or to any other kind of provider that I've worked with in the community. It's discreet, it's confidential, and often there might be a fear about what you'll do with this information. So the only, my only interest really is your well-being. So I just want to make that really clear.
Yeah. When I ask the question about how do we respond, say if we were we were the unofficial or informal peer helping, and we're having a coffee together, and somebody says, well, I'd like to talk to you about the sexual abuse that happened 10 years ago.
Yes.
How would you respond then?
You know, and again, I guess it's a bit tricky. Some people will hear that and for whatever reason will just kind of glance over it as though it didn't exist, you know. Other people that I've talked to hear it, but almost have to kind of hear it again before they kind of process what's happening. So my best advice is always to take on what you're hearing, acknowledge that you've heard them, and then maybe find a way to support them, acknowledging that you're not necessarily an expert yourself, but that there is help available.
I mean, that's when those open-ended questions, the hows, the whats, the wheres, the whys, and the whens, I think can be so powerful because they indicate to the person who's, well, they indicate to the person who's disclosed that there's quite a high level of interest.
Yeah, absolutely. But also acknowledging the fact that if that person's disclosing to you, they might feel very vulnerable at the time. And so it's about it. And so in that moment of vulnerability, it's also about kind of being mindful that you don't want to trigger some kind of response that might put them in a harmful position. So certainly, you know, experiences of what people have told me is that they might get a disclosure, and then before they know it, they might nod their head as in they're hearing what they're saying, and then they might get a full story. For other people, they might nod their head, and then they might just ask that question, what do you want me to do? And I think that might be probably a good way to start, really.
Right. Yeah. How much do you want to say about this?
Absolutely. And it might just be that in that moment, they just want another person to know. Or they might say to you, well, actually, I don't know. This wasn't planned. I didn't wake up this morning and think, right, at 12:35 at coffee, I'm going to disclose I sexually abused.
Right. So. Well, we better go to another music break because we'll be talking to Kieran Moorhead from Changing Minds about another issue of discrimination that's come up through the media. Well, last week we were talking to you under our mental health talking points about a New Zealand general social survey, which surveyed 9,000 people. It showed 75% would accept a neighbour with different sexual orientations or from a minority group or holding different religious views, but substantially fewer would be accepting of one with mental illness. And now we've got a survey that's come out. Can you tell us, it's a bit along the same lines, really, isn't it?
Yeah, there's a health promotion agency survey that showed similar kind of results to us, to the general survey, looking at would it be okay or would people be happy with someone from a sports, well, someone with mental illness playing in a sports team, would they be happy with that compared with would they invite them back to their house for dinner? And the survey found that people would be happy to play in a sports team but not to invite people home.
So they're happy for them to join the sports club as well, and they'll all play together. This was, I think the survey was related to somebody who has schizophrenia.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a view that, that this person, when they're alone, they often shout and argue a little bit. So I don't know whether that's known in the sports club or not, but this is just another case of discrimination.
Yeah, it just highlights the fact that, you know, as it gets closer and closer to home, people become more uncomfortable with the whole issue. So,
was there any indication as to why there was that level of discomfort?
There's no specific indication, but it just shows that there still is discrimination. And it's funny, I don't know if you heard, but a new campaign was launched today called Step Forward NZ, and that's about looking at stigma and discrimination, and it's in conjunction with Like Minds, Like Mine, and HPA.
Oh, okay. So is this an advertising campaign?
Yeah, it's a new campaign that looks specifically at how people with mental illness are being shunned in the community, and they cite the couple of studies that you just mentioned before
is
as
there
reason
enough,
for the campaign.
Is there anything else in that announcement that would be helpful for us to know?
Yeah, it's in partnership with the Herald, the New Zealand Herald, and every Tuesday over the next 3 months, they're going to highlight incidences and effects of discrimination, and they're going to ask readers to support ending mental illness discrimination by signing up to Step Forward at stepforwardnz.co.nz.
Oh, that sounds brilliant. It looks as though this is the next step in the Like Minds campaign, and of course the Health Promotion Agency is now running Like Minds.
Mm-hmm.
So that sounds very good. The HPA is quoted here about the seriousness of discrimination in the survey they've done around sports clubs and that sort of thing. Can you give us a little bit of information there?
Yeah, they say that just how much there is and how it's the biggest barrier to people's recovery.
Yeah, well, we've been talking with Alexander Stevens, who's the chair, of course, of basically Changing Minds. So, we've been talking to him about recovery and some of the obstacles and the importance of hope and that sort of thing. But, yes, that quote from the HBA jumped out of the page at me. It says the HBA is highlighting discrimination because it is one of the biggest barriers to recovery from mental illness. Yeah, Virginia McEwen actually goes on and talks a little bit more. Have you got their press release in front of you?
No, I don't.
Oh, okay. Yeah, because it says British and New Zealand research has shown people with experience of mental illness report discrimination in all aspects of their lives, from employment and housing to discrimination from friends, family and the community. So when you're trying to be part of the community, it's pretty difficult when you're discriminated against.
Yeah, it will be difficult if every aspect of, or every sector of society is, you know, working against you.
Yeah, it sounds as though you've got a few children jumping around in the background there, Kieran.
Oh, yeah, I'm at the community centre today.
Right. Yeah, well, I've been running wellness recovery action plan courses there, and often we have children jumping around above our meeting room, which is, but it's good to have all that passion and excitement going on.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, is this discrimination, is this an issue that Changing Minds has been getting its head around?
Yeah, we look at discrimination on a systemic level, on how we can make sure that systems and structures in society are fighting discrimination. So, yeah, it's good to see all these new campaigns coming up that we're going to be an active involved with.
So that announcement from the Health Promotion Agency, which involves the cooperation of the Herald, is that a media release that's come out today, is it?
Yeah, it was online on the Herald's page and on stuff.co.nz. Yeah, and that's stepforwardnz.co.nz.
Well, brilliant, and thanks very much, Kieran, for alerting us to that. Maybe we could talk a bit more about that next week.
Sounds good. Thanks, Sheldon.
Yeah, thank you.